In this episode of the Winter Folsom podcast, we are exploring some of the reintegration best practices from an Army Ranger. So EJ Menchevez was a decorated combat Army Ranger, left the military and struggled with some reintegration processes, eventually discovering dance as a means of expression, as well as martial arts, building community, ultimately receiving his degree from USC, the Masters of Business for Veterans organization, and transitioning into the role of the warrior in the garden and mentoring others.
All right. Welcome to the Winter Folsom podcast, your source for battle-tested leadership and resiliency. And we have another important conversation and guest for you today, don't we, Philip?
We do. This is actually one of my good friends and ally that I have in the world. I've had a chance to work with this young stallion for years now, Mr. EJ Menchevez here. Just a guy I enjoy spending time with, love the work they're doing in the world. And you have a great story. The background where you came from, going into the Army, the Rangers, your tours, and then coming back and the reintegration process of finding a life that is meaningful and purposeful and continuing to find ways to serve. And so welcome to the Valor Podcast, EJ.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me. Yeah. Excited to be here. Always love talking to you too.
My man. So what age did you go into the military?
18. I graduated high school when I was 17, and then my birthday's in November, turned 18 and went straight in.
I had a similar thing. I actually signed up at 17 and then went in at 18 as well. So
I was 20.
I was trying to get in sooner. My mom wouldn't sign the papers. And then it's actually funny. My best friend from across the street, we're trying to do the thing where we sign up together. His dad is a command sergeant major. And so I was like, we're going to get hooked up. But then he went off and did it. And I got held back because my mom wouldn't sign the paper.
So you went in and went into the Rangers?
First, I started as just a regular grunt. Just
11 Bravo.
With a very basic contract. I felt like I had something to prove. This was also like a very racial time for a lot of people. And there wasn't a lot of Asian men going into infantry. So every single chance I had, I wanted to prove myself. And so when they asked for volunteers for airborne school, I rose my hand. When they asked for volunteers for Ranger school, I rose my hand. And I was lucky enough to be able to finish both of those things. And then deployments and stuff that everybody ends up going through. Every single time there was a situation where they needed someone to do something that nobody else wanted to do, I just kept raising my hand. And that's how I ended up getting further and further and further into the process.
And you ran a sniper unit.
I was not in charge of the entire unit. I had a very small team, which is obviously part of a bigger team. We were all recon. We were all snipers. We were all scouts. And it was pretty challenging. I think because I was the youngest in the group, I was actually the youngest leader. They gave me the younger soldiers and we're all maybe too young to be where we're at. Everybody else had a lot more experience than us. I think because we all were kind of similar in age, we were able to have a different kind of bond.
And how many tours did you do?
I did a year and change my first tour in Afghanistan. I did about another year and change my second deployment.
All these years I've met you, I've never heard, I guess, something to prove story, race-based, like, where's the Asians? Why aren't we represented in that?
I never wanted to make it about that because it honestly wasn't about that, but it was personal to me. You know, nobody else felt that way about me. I think that was something that I made up in my own head. But, hey, you know, everybody has that. Everybody has something in their head.
And this is a great topic for everybody watching. Everybody's got something in their head. Is that same thing drove you to where I met you at the Masters of Business for Veterans program at USC? You still had unfinished business?
Yeah, I'm pretty fortunate. My siblings are dedicated academics. My sister, she's a nurse. I'm not too educated on what the levels are, but I know that she took the extra steps to be more than a hospital nurse. She works at a clinic. It's a lot of a tighter community. It's harder to get to her position. She's a very hardworking woman. And my brother, He finished law school. I don't exactly know his position anymore, but he was a public defender for a little while. Now he's working in a private practice. And so these are really high functioning people. And I just went to the military and got a bachelor's degree in acting. And so I felt like if my siblings can do more, there's got to be something more I can do too. That's how I found myself applying for a graduate program at USC. And they had a specialty for veterans specifically in business. And I didn't particularly want to be in a business realm, but I knew I could do it. I knew it was just me pretending like I'm not capable, but I figured there's no reason why I shouldn't do it. And so when I applied, there's an interview process. And I met this man, James Bogle. He just interviewed me just to see what it was like. And he picked an interview spot that just happened to be really close to a garden that I had built. I was gardening at the time. And we were just talking, getting to know one another. He wanted to know why I wanted to go to a graduate program. And as we were walking, I showed him, I was like, you know, I actually built this. And we were on USC grounds. And so he got curious about how I got there. And turns out I'm just really, really good at networking. That's kind of what inspired him to bring me into the fold. And that's kind of what I focused on when I was in school.
One quick question before we fully leave military world. In the beginning, it sounds like you came in feeling the race conversation. I'm curious, after going through and joining that community, if that shifted, because that was one of the questions we also asked another guest that was a Black man and said, hey, a lot of racial stuff happening in the Black community. Did it change, you know, with the men and women that you were with when you're now fighting and your life's on the line? Does that skin color dissolve, or did you still experience some of that in the community?
I think the best way I can answer that question is when there's nothing going on, someone always finds something to do. And when there's absolutely nothing going on and we're all bored, some of the things we all used to do before the military creeps up back in. And some of those men, I don't regret meeting any of the people that I met. If we weren't there, I would never have been friends with a lot of these people. I don't think there's anything wrong with them. Everyone has their opinions. But some of the racial things that happened was because of what their experience was before the military. And when they would get bored, they would pull on some strings. We would all rag on each other. They would try to pull on my strings that were more racial. And I am a high performing person. There was maybe one or two people that were challenging to me physically and even intellectually. And so anytime one of these guys challenged me on a race card, it's very easily for me to sidestep and just go, that might have hurt if you were actually good enough to challenge me. And so a lot
that's
of
how
that
you
stuff
win, man. That's how you win.
Yeah. A lot of that stuff kept happening only when we were bored. But once work kind of started to pace higher and higher, every single one of those racial people were people that I was able to fully depend on. I really don't think that there was any bad people, at least not on my unit and my team. I think it just happened because we were bored. And sometimes when we're bored, we do stupid things. And we're young. We're between 18 and 25 years old. There's not that much maturity there when we're bored. There was only a few times where it got pretty bad. When I first got into basic training, you know, these are people straight off of the street. And this is 2006, 2007. They're pretty much taking everyone at this point. Waivers or no waivers. People with criminal records, anywhere. And I don't judge anyone. I don't care if you have a criminal record. We're all here to do the same thing. I got into a fight with somebody. They called my friend the N-word. And I tried to stop it because that made me feel a certain type of way. I got in between them. Somehow I got stabbed in the eye. No big deal. It didn't really create much damage. I was in the hospital for maybe a week. And that was like the worst thing that happened. I wore an eye patch for a little while. It was pretty funny. And I still finished. Nothing really bad happened. And the guy who did it, he apologized. He did. It's a really challenging time for people in that situation. I really hated that guy for a while. When we graduated, you know, I kind of just let it go because there was some stuff I was dealing with too. That's like at the hardest 3 months of my life at the time. As far as the racial card elsewhere, the biggest issue is that sometimes I would feel underrepresented. And so then I had to represent really hard.
So you're referring to this, the larger unifying or power of alignment of a shared mission, shared values, a shared vision, that's what the military gives to all of us. And it's one of the reasons why it's so high performing as a culture. Share a little bit about what it was like to lose all that.
I use the word lucky a lot because I don't understand how I was able to transition the way that I did. It's very challenging to get ripped away from a community. And the second I landed in California, I just took a walk. I dropped my bags in my apartment and I just took a walk. I didn't even look inside the apartment yet. As I was walking, I found a karate gym. I just looked inside and there was a really pretty girl at the front desk. She waved me over. She's like, "Here, come over here and check this out." I walk over. They're doing an open gym or open sparring. It's basically a mixed martial arts. Very, very simple. No one's there to prove anything. Everyone kind of just looked like they were there for a workout. And here I am, 24 years old, probably at the height of my physical fitness. I could probably run like 2 marathons if I wanted to at that moment. I walked in, everybody welcomed me. We start sparring. That was the first community that I started to create as soon as I got out. And it was mixed gendered, mixed race. For the most part, nobody cared about my background. They just wanted to train. There wasn't a lot of talking going on, but we all kept connecting more and more every single day. I spent a lot of my time just training in that space. And that was a really good community for me to get part of. I didn't have anyone to like talk to. I didn't feel alone, but I did feel alone. And I didn't know who I could connect with a lot of the things that I was dealing with. I needed something to do because I had just finished being such a good doer. Like I'm so good at it. I found myself alone at night, staying awake, I don't know, sometimes until sunrise, and then having to try to do it all over again the next day. It stayed like that for a while. I made some friends. I made some relationships, and I found that a lot of those people kept getting hurt because I didn't know how to engage. I didn't know how to be someone's friend. I kind of kept trying to create another team. And then when I couldn't rely on someone, they would hear from me and I would be very upset about it. And that kept happening over and over again until the only people that were left were either veterans or people who just happened to be close enough to me to understand it's not them that's the problem, it's me. So they just lovingly accepted those parts of me. And some of those friends are still here today, which I'm really thankful for, but there's not a lot of them. It was a time where I just kept pushing people away every single day.
How's your sleep?
In 2012, I was clocking in 1 to 2 hours a night. And it was like that for a long time. I went to the VA. I also didn't know how to navigate the VA at the time. They gave me sleeping pills. They gave me an offer from a mattress place. And so I got this awesome mattress, these really cool, fancy pillows. I was still clocking in like 1, 2, 3 hours a night. I Googled a lot of the hacks on how to get good sleep. I changed the lighting in my room. I never go anywhere near my bed unless I'm going to sleep in it. All of my electronics stay on my desk. They don't go anywhere near my bed. I turn all the lights to like a red hue after 10 o'clock. And so now it eventually grew to about 3 to 4 hours. More recently, 4 to 5 hours. These past few weeks, I clocked in really close to 6 hours of actual sleep, not just time in bed. I use the Whoop. It's a bracelet that tracks a lot of my medical things. And I tried other stuff, but the Whoop is just convenient for me because I still work out a lot. I still do a lot of things. And I wanted to get the Oura Ring because I think it looks really cool. And I'm pretty sure they all measure the same things. I never wore rings to begin with. And I'm worried I'm going to lose it. Like, that thing is expensive. I just don't want to be that guy that just goes, "Ah, shit.
Josh,
my sleep is getting better."
You had some sleep stuff too. I bring this up is that it's obviously one of the kings of the castle of resiliency and vitality and wellness in general. It's even above nutrition, sleep. And Josh, you struggled with that for a while too. It's a common issue with people coming from high stress fields.
Yeah, I'm still working on it. I got into really good traction. And then this last week I was back down to 4 to 5. And so it's a tough one. You know, I find for me, similar to you, EJ, I've been doing a lot of the changing the lights at night, winding down earlier, but I find I wake up at the same time. And so one of the things I have learned is it's trying to shut down earlier is really the crux of it for me. It's just sometimes I'm wired at night. And that's the other tricky part, is I should be winding down at nine. And sometimes I'm just, and especially now that I'm like getting a lot of things done, I get all these ideas and then I move into implementation. And so that's what I'm learning how to navigate now, is like, how do I not just keep doing things? And how do I become aware of where my mind's stimulated? And back to the resiliency protocols, like doing things to cool down my mind, get back into my body. I've even been doing cold showers at night a lot more now, which is uncomfortable, but it really does start to get me back in my body. Or if I'm laying there and thinking, I'll literally force myself to get up, take a hot shower, then an ice cold shower, and then just try it again. And then even like simpler things like changing out my sheets more frequently, tightening up the bed so that it's taut, you know, just like little details, but they make a big difference. And so that's what I'm working on actively. And it's the number one thing for muscle growth. I mean, there's so many areas. Sleep is just such a primary area. One other additional question for you, EJ. So of all the training you got, I mean, they weaponized you. I mean, airborne, ranger, all the sniper, like all the different training you got. And then you went on multiple tours. How much training did you receive to cope with what you dealt with? Like, they weaponized you to handle the mission, but I'm curious how much training and tools, and like, did they actually train you how to cope and deal with what you took on and what you did to serve that mission? How much reintegration did they give you to say, okay, here's how you deal with this when you come back and reintegrate back into life? Hey, we thank you for listening to the Winter Folsom podcast. Just a couple quick notes. First, if you are a man and you're looking for an honorable and inspiring group of men to hold you accountable and challenge you to grow in your relationships, your fitness, your career, your finances, and your life, go to www.k4men.com. And if you are a veteran, first responder, or man or woman who deals with trauma, and you are looking for some resiliency tools and skills for you, your team, or your organization, go to valorresiliency.com. Hope to see you there. Back to the podcast.
I remember very distinctly that as I was exiting, there was a lot of untested waters on how to exit. And so they had a lot of these civilian groups offer help. And I think because of the conditions I was trained in, I didn't want to go through those things. There were offers. There was definitely people who wanted to do something and help, but I wasn't ready to receive those, as they were all voluntary and they were all untested. Yeah, none of them were mandatory trainings. None of them were like, hey, you have to go through this. And then the things that were mandatory were simple questions like, hey, do you feel like killing yourself? Do you own this? Do you do that? Or they were very just like straight on.
Diagnostic.
I was very much just like, nah, no, I'm good. And they're like, okay, check the boxes. You're good to go. I remember there were offers. I just don't think that as a trigger puller, I want to go through that in those moments. I definitely own some of that. There were definitely programs available. I just chose not to be a part of it because I wasn't ready for it. I didn't want to lose that part of me that was able to do the things I could do. That was my fear, was that I would turn soft. I didn't want to be soft.
And it sounds like the framing to you was untested civilian experimental groups. It wasn't, hey, this is how you get back to life again, now that you're here, and keep your power and keep the framing that it was conveyed. And I, just from all the people I've talked to, I know some really high prior rangers, a lot of the reintegration is trying to teach you how to function. It's not necessarily resiliency focus. It's more, how do you communicate? How do you get a job? They're more logistical, tactical things. That's pretty available now. They call it, I think, like leadership, or they even call some of it resiliency, but it's more, even the Wounded Warrior program, which I was just doing a disabled veteran training currently out at Camp Pendleton. He said they have some thing where you stand on and it trying to get your balance, because sometimes your balance can be off. That's what it does, but they still don't have frameworks to make sense of what's happening and how you reintegrate back, and resiliency protocol. And there's just still a big gap there. So again, you came out at what time?
I got out 2012.
2012. Got it. So, hey, we're a decade later and still no proper training to cope and deal.
And, you know, one of the core pillars of at Valor is that we've researched warrior-based cultures. And number one, every single culture historically and across every geographical area has always had warriors who are the men and women who are willing to do the hard things that others won't. And they have always had ways to reintegrate them 100%. It's a survival protocol for the tribe is that you need to bring these men and women back, that you have to. Otherwise, the tribe suffers and falls apart. We cannot do without them. So we have to find ways to be able to, whether you call it a vision quest or whatever the cultural language is, there has always been ways. And even in World War II, you see the 3-month boat ride back. Well, that's a reintegration process. And you're there with your battle buddies processing through all of the trauma so that you can then bridge across into the next phase of your life, whatever that is. And you're then welcomed by the collective community with parades and the yellow ribbons around the oak trees. And so you're reintegrated back. It is a collective shared trauma process. And we did that organically in World War II and came to a screeching halt in Vietnam, where you were shunned when you got back. You got back via a plane ride. It was immediate. And then we see the train wreck of, you know, all the PTS collateral damage afterwards. And it doesn't seem like we're doing a radically better job. I've heard you speak about dealing with like civilian therapists, for example, and it's tough.
I definitely agree with a lot of that. And I think the part that I really connect to is that the community doesn't know how to receive us anymore. I don't want to blame them. It's just that they just don't know. And one of the biggest reasons why I moved out of New York City, where my entire family is located, when I got back, I felt like I couldn't be around them because I was a completely different person than the one that they knew. I was afraid of them getting to know that new version of me. I wanted them to remember me as the fun, clownish type of person that I was before the military and not the person that I became. And it was very clear. I had a conversation with my brother. We had lunch with one of his friends, and his friend was a therapist. And she told him that I was showing a lot of the signs of PTSD. My brother and I are as close as we can possibly get. We're very, very open about a lot of our stuff. And when he told me that she said that, it was only maybe a few years ago that he told me this. And I was like, wow, I had no idea. And he said he had no idea what he could do about it. He went from being my big brother, who always knew how to be and what to do around me, to going, crap, I don't know how to deal with this guy anymore. I think that's like a big thing that we could, you know, try to usher in, is teaching the community on how to receive veterans again. I think that would be really helpful. If my family knew how to welcome me when I came home, instead of me feeling like I need to run away from them, I think that would be a big thing. And then to talk about the therapists, I tried going to civilian therapists in 2013 and 14. And it's a little challenging when I'm very perceptive. It's very easy for me to recognize patterns. And when I'm saying something, it's very easy for me to tell when the person who's listening gets uncomfortable. And I don't want to cause discomfort for anyone. And so if I'm talking to a therapist and I can see their body get uncomfortable because of my own story, then it gets difficult for me to want to communicate the rest of it. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with a civilian therapist, but if they are inexperienced in some of the traumas that I've been through, you know, I just don't want to put anybody through that. It's not their fault. It's just that they don't know.
Yeah. And I think this is, again, why we're acknowledging there's a massive problem here. And this seems to be the way that keeps getting unfolded is, you know, first, you got to be part of warrior culture to support warrior culture. And secondly, you got to be walking the path. And I think that's one of the reasons why people relate is we're like, hey, we're in the shit with you. So we relate to what you're going through, because if we don't do our protocol, we auger off back into the dirt. And so we're not speaking from, that's why we even call this battle tested, is we're testing it on ourselves and the other people we're working with to say, is it working? And if not, let's find a better solution. And so when it works and we're able to get a result and actually come back to life again, we're like, oh, this works. And so I think it's outside the current realms of, you know, I think we're now looking like, how do we use now science to back up what we're doing? Because we're seeing results and the methodologies, making them very simple to relate to and understand, that are not this big theory-based doctor speaking to you that can't relate, or a civilian that tries to help because they care, but so traumatized by listening to the story, just can't relate, versus warrior culture, who's walking with you, who's applying it and walking through the abyss with you. That's like, hey, come, I'll walk through it with you. I know how to get through this. I know where you're going. I know how to, and I can be compassionate with you because I'm compassionate with myself. And so I think that's where we're really wanting to usher this conversation into a new place. And in addition to the resiliency, walking with you, warrior based, it's also community. And I think the community also has to have more civilian. And I think that's one of the things we've learned about K4 is, you know, you bring fire, police, veterans combined with civilian culture, and you actually create a really safe container for humans to share together where there's safety. And now you start to get seen. You're like, oh, right? Like the civilians start to welcome you back because they get it. Because a lot of times, even as special forces, sometimes you even sign contracts saying, I can't even disclose what I did. I went and fought to protect my country, and now I can't even tell a soul what I did. So there's no witnessing. There's no recognition. It's just, I did this to serve you and I'm proud of it. I personally think there's a lot coming back that we need to be witnessing and celebrating our warriors and reintegrating them back into the culture. So the civilian world goes, I get it now. I actually knows what it means when somebody says, thank you for serving my country. It means, oh, you actually gave your life and you were willing to risk your life to protect me. Whether or not I agree with the government, whether or not I agree with political decisions for the veteran men and women that chose to serve, like fucking thank you, not just thank you, but like, I fucking get it. And that's, I think, the part that's missing. We've talked a lot about just a thank you feels dismissive a lot of times to veteran community when somebody's like, thank you for your service. It's like, if they don't get it, it feels, but we get it. Same thing you said, they don't get it. They have literally no clue. So they're trying their best without any awareness because we protected the civilian culture from what actually happens. So it's interesting times. I guess one other question is, you naturally found your way into martial arts, which is a form of resiliency, right? Like a really powerful way of, especially like
warrior culture.
You naturally came back to warrior culture. You're naturally, when you're grappling and you're doing things, it's forms of resiliency. There's physical contact, your exercise, right? You're able to get some of that resiliency. And then you moved into, which I think is amazing, by the way, you moved into dance, which is another powerful way. It's a purification practice from our lens and valor of, there's regulation, which is more regulating your nervous system. And then there's purification, which is, how do you take this dense, heavy fucking sludge and transmute it into something else? And dance is a really powerful way to move that into something creative and expressive. And so I'm really curious, how did you move into art, which I see that is art and creativity and like really epic type of art too, not just like different types, but really powerful. I'm curious how you ended up in dance and movement.
That's I've been thinking a lot about more recently. I'm very attracted to powerful leaders. I can't help but be inspired by anyone that has the ability to command presence and then also inspire and motivate. I was at Santa Monica College, you know, just studying, getting my general educations in so that I can transfer to USC. And I walked by a room filled with ballerinas, all beautiful women. And I just had finished 6 years of being in a highly male dominant realm. And so as I'm walking by, my eye catches a few things I liked to see. And the teacher just walks over and she goes, you want to come inside? I was like, yeah. And so I come in, I sit down, I'm watching. And I've always thought of ballet as boring, but this wasn't, they were training. And now training to me is not boring. And so as I saw all of them struggle to physically do the things they were trying to do, it started to click that they're all just training. They're all doing the same thing that I know how to do. They all know how to persevere, and that's what they're trying in that room. They're all meeting this wall and choosing not to quit. That's the first thing that started to get me into, ooh, this looks like something I want to be a part of. And then one day I was walking by that same room, and this time there was another group of people in there. There was a group of people who were auditioning for the dance company at the school. And I decided to go in. I auditioned. And like I said before, I'm at like a peak physical part of my life. I'm about 205 pounds, probably not an ounce of fat. You know, if anybody needed something to get picked up, I could probably do it. And if I wanted to put it back down and pick it back up, I could probably do it. So they let me on very easily. You know, there's not a lot of guys in the room. And my first choreographer, her name is Karen McDonald. And she is this very powerful woman, much older, Black. She was a part of Alvin Ailey. She choreographed a lot of wonderful things. She performed with some of the biggest stars. She's front row, front next to Michael Jackson in the Thriller music video. And she's a monster. She knew I had absolutely no training whatsoever, but she also knew that I know how to train. And so she was so hard on me. She said, "You look like you want to be here. Everyone else has been here for a long time. You're going to have to do a lot if you want to stick around." And every day, she did not treat me like somebody who had any type of privilege just because I was strong. She was really hard on me. And I think that helped me connect to it. I loved that. I loved it when somebody was giving me that kind of attention. And she believed in me 100%. I stuck around with her for 2 years. I took all of her classes, from modern to ballet to any performance that she would like me to be a part of. And every single time, it was always so personal. Everything that we did had an emotional journey that needed a lot from me. And I found myself capable of giving that type of emotion during a performance that I wasn't able to be emotional anywhere else. I couldn't let my emotions out anywhere else. But somehow I could on stage. Somehow I could when I was connecting with those dancers. And shortly after that, other people started to recognize that I was improving. And then I started getting hired for more things. I mean, this is Los Angeles. There's plenty of entertainment to go around. Then for years after that, I just kept getting hired over and over and over again. And I owe it all to Karen McDonald from Santa Monica College. She's the director at Debbie Allen's Dance Academy now. And I think about her all the time and her leadership, because she really just took the time to just take some muscle-bound veteran into a group of artists who had no idea how to deal with me. And I was quiet. I didn't really say much. I don't really know that many people from that time, except for her. I don't talk to a lot of those people anymore, maybe one or two, but they all remember me. And sometimes when I run into them, they go, "Hey, I remember when you did this, this, and this." And in my head, I'm like, I have no idea who this is. And so that meant a lot to me. And being able to use my emotions and to feel again during a time when all I wanted to do was not feel anything, it meant a lot. And I still perform today. There's another group in downtown Los Angeles called Diavolo, and they have another leader who's very similar, very militaristic. He's not all about feelings or trying to make the best show. He's more about pushing individuals and wanting them to be the best versions of what they can possibly be. And so I can connect with that. He has a veterans project that he runs, and his name is Jacques Heim. Really cool dude, super offensive to people because he's so direct with his communication. He doesn't care about any of this other bullshit. And, you know, a lot of people aren't ready for that, but I am. I like that kind of stuff. It still helps me connect with my emotions. Like, oh, when I go here, I get to feel again instead of run away from it. That's why I still keep dancing. That's why I still keep connecting with that type of stuff.
I've seen you, two of your Diavolo performances, just incredibly powerful. You personally, but also that organization, highly recommend, go check that out. If you had a chance to just crystallize your journey into a little diamond of either advice or some questions to people who are either reintegrating now or they have and they're struggling, if you were to look at kind of the arc of your story, what are the few of the best practices that would give them a shortcut to avoid some of the pitfalls and the long journeys that you've been on?
I think first and foremost, I would say to not look for the shortcuts, because I think that's what I kept doing. I kept looking for shortcuts. And I think what really 100% probably helped me get to the little bit of movement and success that I find myself in now is looking for a mentor. I think that was the most instrumental of my entire journey.
You're an important person in people's communities too. You organically create and join communities. That may have been one of your salvations as well.
I do want to connect and be a part of stuff. The biggest challenge that I have is that there's many times throughout my day where I just don't want to be here anymore. And suicide is rampant, and I'm trying not to be one of those numbers, but that's what I deal with. And like I said, if it wasn't for some of the people who take the time out of their day to connect with me and mentor me and remind me that there's more for me to do, there's more for me to serve, because that seems to be something I want to keep doing. If it wasn't for a lot of that, I think it would be very challenging for me to keep going forward.
Well, in my experience of getting to work with you, not only doing youth leadership programs, but all the corporate work we've done, work with you at Red Bull and all the different organizations we've worked with, and your leadership in the K4 men's community, there'd be a hole without you, man. So I'm glad you're born. I'm glad you're here, and stick around for a while. We need you. We need you in the shield wall, bro.
Doing my best.
I think there's a lot of power from your story of just maybe civilians will be listening to this and that actually start to understand what's happening. And then two, I love that you found dance and movement, man, because you took something that's typically perceived as more feminine or could be perceived as weak, and your framing on it is so powerful, because it's like, oh no, this is training to become the best possible version of you. And in that, you get to feel. And I think that's a big part of that too, because that's a big part of what happens in trauma is we get disconnected from our body, because that's how we cope, right? We cope from staying on mission and disassociating. And so reconnecting here starts to bring us back online. It's just a little bit of a messy journey going through that and having a place to transmute that on a regular basis. And I think that's also a big part of your work and your progress, is that's more and more bringing you back online. The more you continue to practice, have community, express yourself, express that movement, right, is part of it. And then I think that at least what's coming up for me as you're sharing is I feel mentorship for you. Like, I feel like that could also be a primary way to navigate. Like, what could that look like where you start to mentor maybe somebody just getting out? That could be another powerful service and mission role of like, oh, wow. Because a lot of times it's transmuting our pain into purpose, and somebody else that's in the same pain that now you start to go, oh, there's meaning here, right? That's like, oh, wait, maybe this happened so that I could serve them and help show them the same route that I found. Maybe it's a younger version of you and you relate to them and they're open and excited to learn and just need a little direction. And now it becomes you now step into that same role has been happening for you to someone, which creates a whole nother level of mission and purpose. So just an invitation there. I don't know if that resonates, but I was feeling that really strong as you were talking, like, wow, if that's been your primary piece, what could that look like? You know, to have somebody coming out that you take under your wing and help kind of craft and mold them and challenge the shit out of them, you know, to become better. And so that just came up pretty strongly as we were talking. I feel the same way, man. You're such an asset and an ally and just an amazing man and human, man. I'm grateful to have you as a brother, as an ally. I mean, you have this really loving nature. And Philip and I have talked about this with some of the deadliest humans on the planet are usually the most gentle, loving humans, because they don't have anything to prove, because they can, you know, all the black belts and high level octane special forces guys we find are all very similar of just loving humans, because you've seen in some instances the worst of what humanity can be. So you really represent that warrior in the garden, like, hey, and that's even what I see is the dance and the movement is like, I get to be here for a little while and softening into that, because you can handle the hard shit all day long. I think you are an example of what Philip and I talk about is that man in full, right? Continually man in full is I can handle my shit and I can protect and provide. And you're just learning the other side of that, right? Like, how do I come back to life and feel again? So really grateful for you, brother.
Thank you.
And I always say, instead of thank you for your service, welcome home. Welcome home, baby. Welcome home.
You mentioned the mentoring thing, and that's the thing that keeps coming up a lot lately. And I've been noticing there's a story with one of the wolves at Apex about how Thor just did not want to become the alpha, but turns out he's the one that everybody needed to become the alpha. And I've been noticing lately people reaching out to me for guidance. And I'm like, fuck, I don't want to be that for someone because I'm afraid I'll do it wrong or I'm afraid I'm going to mess it up. But constantly, I would say on a daily basis now, people have been asking that of me. You know, I keep turning it down the best I can, but I know it's something that I'm slowly moving into. And so I really appreciate you encouraging me. I think that's probably something that I'm going to be doing really soon now.
Fate guides those who will and those who won't, she drags. You can only avoid it for so long, bro.
So a challenge for today, what would be a good challenge? Somebody's listening. I really liked the reframe from thank you for your service to welcome home. That feels like a solid reframe on acknowledging a veteran. I would also say one potential challenge could be, whether you're a veteran or not, start a conversation if you find out somebody's a veteran and ask questions and get to know them, you know, welcome them home and get to know them. Who are they? Make them feel at home. That could be one potential challenge. Any other ones that come up for either you, EJ, or Philip? We always leave with the challenge as we end.
I've been getting to the point now where I'm open to talk about my experience, and I don't necessarily mind people asking me about it anymore. I think eventually veterans can get to that point. I will challenge my civilian friends to either ask me or someone they know that's a veteran that might have gone through something and see if they're open to talk about it, because I'm definitely more open now. And every single time someone genuinely and authentically wants to know about it, not because they're curious, but more because they want something, they want to feel more connected to me, you know, don't be afraid to ask anymore. If there's trust, if we trust each other, you know, I know you're not trying to hurt me when you ask me about my experience. If we're best friends, then you're probably allowed to know about it too.
Right on. Well, from one battle-tested warrior to the others, it's been an absolute honor, EJ, to have you on this Winter Folsom podcast. And it's a blessing to have you in our community. And stay battle-tested, everyone.